Dallas Theological Seminary's Chapel Podcast.
Today's chapel speaker is Dr. Brian Webster, who serves as Associate Professor of Old Testament Studies. In the course of his professional career, he has worked as a research fellow at the Scriptorium, cataloging cuneiform texts and working with Hebrew scrolls. He's taught Greek as well as Hebrew at Cornerstone University in Grand Rapids, the Puritan Reformed Theological Seminary, and has served as an Associate Professor of Bible and Chair of the Bible Religion and Ministry Division at Cornerstone University prior to coming to Dallas Seminary. His research interests are lament, Hebrew poetry, and the Psalms, and he has won several teaching awards and recognition in Who's Who among America's teachers. Brian and his wife Hope have three girls, Angela, Lily, and Robin. Dr. Webster comes to speak to us today on the important theme out of Deuteronomy chapter 6, the Shema. Would you welcome Dr. Brian Webster to our platform this morning?
Seems I haven't updated my personal info somewhere along the way. We have four girls. The youngest one is Starla, and I think I spotted her coming in. Hello. Well, as you may have noticed, the Old Testament is the bulk of the Bible. It's almost as long as Dr. Honer's commentary on Ephesians. I won't repeat that. The foundation of the Old Testament is the Torah, or the five books of Moses. And the summary, the summation of the Torah is the book of Deuteronomy. And the heart of the book of Deuteronomy is Deuteronomy 6, 4 through 9, where it says, Shema Yisrael, Adonai Eloheinu, Adonai Echad. Listen, Israel, the Lord is our God, the Lord alone. Ve'ahavta et Adonai Eloheka, b'kol levavaka, uv'kol nafshika, uv'kol me'odeka. It is the Lord alone, and so you shall love the Lord your God with all your levav, and with all your being, and with all your vigor. The Shema is a named verse in Judaism. It is the fundamental confession of Judaism from the time of Moses to the current day. And the Ve'ahavta is a named verse in Judaism. You shall love the Lord your God with all your levav, which traditionally is translated with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your strength. We're going to briefly look at the Ve'ahavta in the New Testament. Matthew 22, 37, with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your mind. Mark 12:30, loving the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind, and all your strength. Luke 10:27, you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your strength, and with all your mind. The verses take different approaches on how to get all the pieces in there. Should we get just three in there that are present in the Old Testament? Should we add a fourth? Should we rearrange the order? But one thing seems to be clear. The New Testament writers, Jesus, seems to be very set on telling the audience that we need to love the Lord our God with our mind. Where does that come from? It comes from that word levav. You shall love the Lord your God b'kol levavaka, with all of your mind. This is an important concept today, because we're going to be thinking a little bit about our mind in this passage. The biblical writers are not making a distinction between head knowledge and heart knowledge. Right? We've heard the distinction, head knowledge is bad and heart knowledge is good, and then why are we at seminary? That distinction is not made in Scripture. In the Old Testament, if you wanted to make that sort of a distinction, you would talk about how these people honor me with their lips, but their levav, their mind and their heart, are far from me. And the mind is very important in the way we love God. I'm going to jump a slide here. And just take the opening proposition. Listen, Israel, the Lord is our God, the Lord is one. And we often think, okay, well, the difference between polytheism and monotheism is that there's one God or there are many gods. But this isn't really the distinction between monotheism and polytheism, not alone. A bigger issue, perhaps, is where is power located? In polytheism, power exists above and beyond the gods. One god can use power against another god. Humans can use power against humans. Human can use power against gods. Gods can use power against humans. Power exists above and beyond the gods. Nobody controls all of it. Yet in monotheism, power is the sole province of the one god. So we have a difference that in polytheism we have many gods who have some power, but they aren't necessarily good. They're rather like us, full of both evil and good. They mistreat each other, they kill each other, they steal from each other. And in monotheism we have one God who has all the power, and by the way, he is good. Now you can take a worldview concept like that and analyze a lot of things, like the difference between the book, The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, and the movie, The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. Because in the book, it will say, or Aslan will say, that the deep magic belongs to the emperor over the sea. And when Lucy will ask him, well, can't you do anything to work against the emperor's magic? He will make a little growl and say, work against the emperor's magic? This cannot be done, right? But in the movie, it's just, there is a deep magic that governs all our lives. And so in the movie, we've made power on top, Aslan is subordinate to it, etc., so forth. In the book, the emperor over the sea is the one person who has all the power, and he is good. And you could look at lots of different movies that involve magic or whatnot, and use that kind of a grid to think through their worldview. But in terms of where Israel is in its surrounding culture, this is a huge thing, and we could spend an entire semester on this. We're just going to do rapid fire. What are some of the implications of one God has all the power and he is good? Well, that means that the one God is moving history toward his own goals, toward his own ends. History is linear. It's not circular as in Egypt. In Egypt, history is circular. It's supposed to go in a certain pattern, do what the gods have always done, and that gives them stability. Over in Mesopotamia, history is unstable, but it is linear, but it's unstable because you can never rely on what the gods are going to do. In monotheism, where one God has all the power and is good, he will send a flood in order to punish people for their moral evil. In polytheism, where there are many gods who have some power, they will send a flood because, well, the humans are being noisy and bothersome and we can't get enough sleep. In monotheism, the one God gives the law to the people in order to clarify what righteousness is and what his character is. In polytheism, Hammurabi will present Shamash with his code of laws in order to show, look, I'm keeping an orderly society. We're not going to be too noisy and keep you from sleep, and therefore you ought to make me king. Two different purposes for the law. We could go on and on. It's a huge concept. It was a huge concept for them to work out. What does it really mean for there to be just one God with all the power and him to be good? It changes the whole way you lament. Right? In polytheism, you never know what the gods expect. They're capricious and fickle. You don't know why you're being beat up by the gods. You go and you make sacrifices and you confess every known sin, whether you've committed it or not, just in case they got confused. We have a whole different problem of evil in monotheism, which again could be a complete day. But the people of Israel needed to work this out and pass it on to their children. Let me back up a second. So in Deuteronomy 6:6, where it says, "V'hayu hadivarim ha'ela asher anoki mitzavaka hayom al levaveka. These words which I am commanding you today are to be on your levav, and the English idiom, on your mind, is the best translation because of what comes next. These words are to be on your mind because you are to regularly instruct them to your children. You are to speak with them when you sit in your house, when you travel on the way, when you lie down, and when you rise. The English idiom, on your mind, is far better than on your heart in this case, because things that are on your mind are the things that we talk about. Where is our attention set? Right? You notice in the New Testament, how are we transformed? We're transformed by the renewing of our minds. We're told to set our minds on things above, not on things of the earth. We're told, well, King James said, gird up the loins of your mind. I think Net has get your minds ready for action or something like that. If it's very interesting in the New Testament to correlate passages about ethical behavior with the mind. You'll find a heavy correlation there if you undertake that study. The mind is very important in honoring God, and if we're going to pass that to children, his commands, his words need to be on the forefront of our mind so that we speak them all the time. And if his words are on our mind, perhaps then we can do the remaining verses. You shall bind them as a sign on your hand. They shall be tote-a-fote between your eyes. In my family, when we recite these verses, we do it anachronistically. We say, let them be lenses for your eyes, because nobody really knows what tote-a-fote are. And you shall write them on the doorposts of your house and on your gates. We won't go into the debate on how much of this is a command to do something physical, like wear a box on your head, as Orthodox Jews do, or tie something on your arm. We take it as, let your lifestyle be characterized by these words from God himself. Live in such a way that you have put the imprint of his words on how you live. Let your kids see that. So looking at this passage, and it's so short we hardly need to summarize, but we begin with a proposition. Listen, Israel, one God for us, Yahweh, and there is a response. Love the Lord your God. Have allegiance to that person. These words which I'm commanding you today, adopt them as your worldview. Teach your children regularly. Constant talk, even for guys, right? The psychologists tell us that we have 5,000 or 6,000 words per day and that women have like 40,000 words per day. right, because this is a dad's first thing, I believe. And bind them on your hand, let them be lenses for your eyes, inscribe them on your homes, let it be the character of your behavior. Because the Lord alone is God, is our God, we should have complete allegiance to him, expressed by embracing his words and keeping them on our minds, speaking them constantly to our children, and having them characterize how we live. But we know the baton can be dropped, as it were. Judges 2. The people served the Lord all the days of Joshua and all the days of the elders who survived Joshua, who had seen all the great work of the Lord which he had done for Israel. And all that generation were gathered to their fathers, and then there arose another generation after them who did not know the Lord, nor yet the work which he had done for Israel. And it begins to tell us the cycle. The Israelites did the evil in the eyes of the Lord, and the Lord raised up so-and-so who oppressed them for this many years. And then the Israelites cried out to the Lord, and the Lord raised up a deliverer, and he delivered them, and they had rest for so many years, and they did it over and over and over again. The baton was regularly dropped. So I want to think about the drop, dropping the baton, not passing on these values to the next generation. There's, from this passage, at least four different ways we can drop the baton. We might not set our minds on his words. That is, we might not pick up the baton and hold it and grasp it to begin with. We might not understand his words or the threats that there are to passing the baton off. We fail to assess how to pass, or we just have bad technique, even if we have good intentions. Or we do not speak his words constantly to our children. We assign the task maybe to other people or when it fits in my schedule. And we fail to practice and repeat the handoff because handing this off to the next generation is not a one-time thing. I can't just go, here, take it, and it's done. You have to hand it off a million times and hope that they hold what you've handed off. Or perhaps a failure to stamp his words on our lifestyle. We have failed, perhaps, to be a model runner, and therefore the next generation does not run the race well. We're not going to look so much at why did the Israelites in the time of the judges drop the baton, but just reflect on some of the ways we might drop the baton. And I'm going to focus on the latter ones in this list, the earlier ones that are mentioned in the Shema. We might simply not live it. I don't think we need a lot of discussion here. We might fail to speak it. One of the reasons why we might fail to speak it is because of this notion that has crept up about spending quality time with our children. And letting that somehow displace the real fact, I believe, that is quantity time is quality time. And that we only find teachable moments when we have a whole bunch of other moments in our relationship with our children. But it's not setting our minds on it or not using a good passing technique that I would just like to muse on a little bit to get our thinking in a certain way. Because sometimes we're trying to do a particular thing and it seems like it makes sense, but it may not accomplish the goal that we want. So, for example, what about how we celebrate Christmas? How much of the way we celebrate Christmas is focused on the birth of the Savior versus promoting materialism versus maybe that quest for the perfect day of family life? Now, we're thinking mostly about the children side of things. Children, of course, are very concrete in their thinking processes. And so when we have everybody over, all the relatives come over for Christmas Day, and we're going to have the big meal, and we take 75 seconds to read a few verses from Luke 2 to put an umbrella on it all, and then spend 3 hours with presents, the children pick up the concrete much more than the 75 seconds of reading select verses of Luke 2. And so the question is, well, what have we actually taught them, and have we thought these kinds of things through? I'll share you what we do in our family. It's not what you have to do in your family, and have to give credit to my wife. She's done a lot of careful thinking about holidays and traditions for our family, and I hope she writes a book on this someday. But in our family, what did we do to remove materialism from Christmas? Well, one of the first things we did was we removed presents. You can't do that. Isn't that child abuse? No, we removed presents. Now, because of, extended family issues, we might exchange presents at Thanksgiving. We might exchange presents at New Year's. We do not exchange presents on Christmas because Christmas is Jesus' birthday. And so we've decided that each child, when they have their birthday, it's their day. It's a big day. There's lots of hoopla. It's about their birthday. But Christmas is Jesus' birthday, so Jesus should get all the presents, and there should be lots of hoopla, and it should be about Jesus' birthday. So there's a birthday cake, which is Jesus' birthday cake. There's a time for giving presents, which we typically do online. We go to various ministries. We tell each child X amount of dollars, and we donate Bibles to various places. We donate money toward maybe a bike for an evangelist in the third world. We maybe do things that are anti-poverty, but in a Christian ministry context. And we just sit there and we go through different options. And the kids say, I would like to do that. And so we fill it in and we give them. It's not any cheaper, okay? It's taking presents out of Christmas, not any cheaper. When we lived in Michigan, we would take the kids to a homeless shelter to serve at one of the meals. Down here, we take our children to a retirement home, and we serve the old people. They put on a program. My wife's initial efforts at this have paid off to the extent that we don't have to make the program anymore. The kids design it. They make a worship program for at home, right, which we don't have to design anymore. And the day is about Jesus' birthday, not about presents for us. Now, there's more than one way that you can celebrate Christmas. You might reflect that if you did something like we do, people will think you're weird. Okay? It's part of what happens if you go counterculture. What about socialization? Just to change topics, we're just going to set some topics out here, and then we're going to kind of turn them around and look at them a different way. Kids need socialization, right? But what kind? What proportion? What results? For example, socialization. Aren't the following things socialization? Teasing, bullying, being bullied, focus on clothes, cliques. Isn't socialization the rise of oral gonorrhea among junior hires? I think so. Socialization is a lot of things. Why is it that socialization should only be done with people whose birthday is 364 days apart from yours or less? There's a saying by Rob Shearer. I'm not sure if he started the saying, but I always cite him when I use this. Kids don't socialize kids. Adults socialize kids. Right? If our goal is to raise children to become responsible adults, what is the proportion of socialization that ought to be outside of peer group? Kids socialize kids, sure, but what results? It's not always bad, it's not always good, but the question is, what is the proper proportion? And somehow, a lot of discussions of socialization seem to focus only on peer socialization. Well, what about teenagers? Here's a little pop quiz. The first documented use of teenager was 1526, Tyndale's English New Testament, 1623, Shakespeare's Romeo and Juliet, 1739, Franklin's Poor Richard's Almanac, 1899, Roosevelt's Strenuous Life Speech, or 1941 in a Reader's Digest issue. Did you vote for E? That is correct. How could the concept of a teenager be so recent? Well, partly it was the compulsory attendance laws that America put in place in the beginning of the 1900s, and that extended the amount of time that children were forced to be in school, and it changed the nature of their socialization away from apprenticeships with adults and towards socialization with peers. My children have an American Girl doll and some American Girl books, so I pulled the one relevant to the 1940s. By the time girls like Molly turned 13, they thought of themselves as teenagers. During the 1940s, people began to see that the teenage years were a special stage of life, and that teenagers had their own special interests. For the first time, fashions were created just for teenagers. Teenagers listened to their own music. They read their own magazines and spent time at their own hangouts. How cool. Teenagers learned how to drive cars and could go out on dates without adults being with them. Now, of course, in the context of the Molly books and American Doll, they're just trying to orient the reader to the era. But you could look at that from a different perspective and say, so you mean teenagers became a distinct marketing target group, and they acquired enough independence and lack of supervision to get themselves in trouble? Right, just same issue, look at it from another side. Is it really any surprise to us when we think about it that if the first people to be called teenagers are people in the 1940s, that we go only one generation, right? The children of the first people called teenagers are the children of the 60s sexual revolution. There was a big baton drop there in the 60s. Is it really that surprising that changing the socialization of this group away from apprenticeship to adults and toward socialization with each other might lead to or contribute to a negative consequence? Now, if we were a social scientist, we would look at a whole bunch of other factors, but it's an interesting thing to think about, I think. We won't go through this entire quote. J. Michael Smith's talking about teens, and he's quoting here some research by Robert Epstein, and who has been talking about this concept. Well, you know, teenagers, they just rebel. It's just the way they are. You have to work through this phase or this stage, but doing the research then through other cultures and other times in American history, it's not the case that it is inevitable that teenagers rebel. It's rather specific to our culture, which would make you wonder some things. The final paragraph here, Mr. Epstein concludes that the peer culture of teens, where they learn virtually everything they know from one another rather than from the people they are about to become, is the cause of the problems we see today. Almost all teens are isolated from adults and wrongly treated like children. We could keep going. I'll just take this next one and skip ahead because of this factor of time. Compulsory attendance. Is education important? Sure. And so you have some voices in society that say, education's important. We need to spend more. We need to build better buildings. We need rigorous programs. We need to support the teachers. Yada, yada, yada. Is education important? Sure, absolutely it is. But when you take a compulsory attendance law and you set it down on the table, you just might walk around to the other side and say, did you really mean to make a law that made it illegal to raise children at home? Did you really mean to make a law that would almost, for a time, make it illegal to use apprenticeship as a major educational choice? There was a time where in many states in America, homeschooling was illegal, right? And it's still under attack today, but that's what a compulsory attendance law was, a law that made it illegal to raise children at home. Are we for education? Sure, but what does it take in our culture for parents to be at least 51% of the world-shaping influence on their children? Ouch. Now, I think if we read that passage, our percentage, our goal ought to be way, way higher, but just for sake of argument. If parents only had to be 51% of the world-shaping view influence on their children, what would that take? How many of our families pull that off? Okay. Quick questions for the church. This is intended only as a tool for you to think about things. I'm just going to read them because we have another important topic to get to. In the church, who is together? Are families together or separated? What percentage of the time? See, some churches will say, yes, we're very family friendly. And then someone from another culture shows up and say, you're family friendly, but the first thing you do is disband the family to different parts of the building. What's going on? So is the result the desired balance, and has it been achieved by design or by afterthought? What's on the schedule? How much of the things on the schedule at church are age group driven? How much is cross-generational? How much is intra-family? What kind of verbiage gets used around the church? Do phrases and presentations and discussions demonstrate an assumption of or concern for parents teaching God's word in a biblical worldview? I mean, is it natural to hear someone at church say, so when you're teaching this to your children, does that come up? Is it a standard assumption or goal that parents are talking constantly about God's word to their children? Or have we just said, look, that never happens, we have to do something else? Socialization. Where are the teens? Who are they with? Who is socializing whom? Who constructs meaning? What is the assumed role of dads? What is the proposed role of dads? If a family did all the stuff our church hopes they do, in, at, or with the church, would that help or hinder the parents to be at least 51% of their children's worldview influence? How much adult curriculum in the last 5 years equips parents to teach their children or to assess the worldview influences on their children, or to out-influence all other worldview influences on their kids, or even simply to provide settings for parents to discuss these. Because you might argue, look, this is the province of the home, and so we're going to leave it to the parents. But if it's entirely absent in how one thinks about education in the church, it seems to me that something is quite out of place. I have one other topic to try and address this morning. I can leave those questions for you if you want to use them just as analysis, because a lot of you are going to be involved in church ministry or are now. But parental rights imply, or excuse me, parental responsibilities imply parental rights. It's like thou shalt not steal implies that there are property rights. Well, what kind of parental rights do we have, and what is the current status of parental rights? Parental rights were so broadly assumed at the founding of our country that they were not stated explicitly in the Constitution. They have long been recognized as a fundamental right by the Supreme Court. Now, fundamental right is a technical term. Fundamental rights mean the following: the government cannot intervene unless its interest is of the highest order and cannot be otherwise served. Now, this affects our topic today as we understand the phrase, the best interests of the child. For the last 400 years, going back to colonial days, the understanding of when the best interests of the child comes into play is when the family can be demonstrated to be broken. There's four ways to demonstrate a family has been broken: death of parents, divorce, abuse, and neglect. When one of those has been demonstrated, it is the government's highest interest to intervene and to act in the best interests of the child. But because parental rights are not explicitly stated in the Constitution, they've become subject to certain threats. One of the biggest threats today is that the phrase, the best interest of the child, is getting moved to a completely different context. Let's illustrate with a few cases. This is a case in Washington in the 1983, the Sumi case. It's a kind of a landmark case where parents basically caught their daughter with drug paraphernalia and evidence of escalating sexual involvement, which was outside the parents' desires, and so they grounded her. She complained to her high school counselor. Her high school counselor connected her with Child Protective Services. They got her removed from the home. Parents tried to go to court and regain custody. They lost. Another case in Washington, a 13-year-old boy lived in a home where his parents took him to church Sunday morning, Sunday evening, Wednesday evening. He complained to his school counselor. He didn't want to go to church that often. School counselor got a hold of Child Protective Services, got him removed from the home. Parents came to court, and the judge said, you know, I think once a week is enough. Now, would the parents have won this case? Yeah. But it would cost a lot of money, take a lot of time while their son was not living with them, and so they capitulated. They agreed they would only take their child to church once a week and thus reduce the conflict in the home over which the court had decided it needed to intervene. I brought several cases that we'll have to do in the time that we have. Let me tell you where the Supreme Court stands. The most recent ruling that affects parental rights was a 1991 case, Troxell versus Granville. And the court voted 6-3 in favor of parental rights there. That might sound encouraging, but there was actually no clear majority. The 6 was 4+1+1, and the 3 was 1+2 who opposed it. So there were four justices that argued that parental rights are fundamental rights that are implied in the Constitution. They were Rehnquist, O'Connor, Breyer, and Ginsburg. You may note that Rehnquist and O'Connor are no longer on the court. Clarence Thomas also sided with parental rights, but he noted that there was a key, an important element that neither side had brought up, and suggested that if either one of them had brought it up, he might have voted otherwise. And then there was Souter. Souter voted on the side of the parents, but did not endorse the idea that parental rights are fundamental rights. On the opposite side was Scalia, Stevens, and Kennedy. Stevens feared that if the court recognized parental rights as an implied right, that would take the power on to reinterpret it whenever they wanted. Interestingly, Stevens and Kennedy, who voted against the parents in this, were basically going exactly that direction. It's not a fundamental right, and the court ought to step in and decide these things however it wants to. So with two of those justices gone, the seven that remained, you had groups of two, one, 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 and two. Right? No clear philosophy from the court at this time on parental rights. The other thing that is growing as a problem is the courts looking to international law, and international law is largely redefining, quote, the best interests of the child, taking their cues much from the United Nations Convention on the Rights to the Child. Let me skip ahead to a couple things there. In fact, I will move to Article 14. States parties shall respect the right of the child to freedom of thought, conscience, and religion. What you need to read here is the child's freedom of religion, meaning the parents shall have no right to teach their children that there is only one way to God. The convention also recognizes the child's right to privacy in Article 16. You need to read that as privacy from parents. Now, we already know what the Supreme Court has done with privacy from parents regard to abortion. This gets worse. In the 2004 UN Committee review of Japan's compliance, they stated explicitly that parents ought not to have a right to monitor their child's use of the internet or read what they were posting or using an email. I'll let your imagination run a little while on that. In the brown bag that we're having later, I will address more of the articles here. I want to just briefly move on to a defense against the UN Convention. Do we need to be concerned about the UN Convention? Yes. The United Nations Convention on the Rights of the Child was signed by the President of the United States. It was signed in 1995. Did not go to the Senate at that time because there was not enough support for it. But as you know, White House and Senate changes, and it could come back. But here is an amendment introduced by Pete Hoekstra last July 4th, approximately. The liberty of the parents to direct the upbringing and education of their children is a fundamental right. This amendment has three sections, which we'll go over in detail in the brown bag, but it is designed to be sure that you are not protecting parents who do things harmful to their children. But that does allow the state to step in when you prove the family is broken, as it's always been understood in American law. But the last section will specifically prevent the UN Convention, even if it were ratified by the Senate, it will prevent it from having any significance in American law. So as we conclude, the Shema calls us to recognize there is one God, which brings a certain set of values with it that we are to pass on to our children. We need to think carefully how we might do that, on the one hand, as parents. We need to examine what we do in church structure that supports or does not support that value. And we need to be very concerned and not let it be off our radar screen in the midst of economic upheaval. We need to be very concerned about the legal situation in America today. So I highly recommend to you visiting the site parentalrights.org, finding out more about this issue, and coming to the brown bag.